Thank you. Please be seated. We're merely in recess and not convening. Senior Justice has been reminding me of.
The court is ready to hear argument today in the matter of N. Ray, Perry, and Clay Art, an original mandamus proceeding. We're ready to hear argument from the lawyer.
May I please report? Mr. Andy Taylor will present argument for the relator. The relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the first letter in the acronym LRB stands for legislative. And that's for a reason, because the Texas constitutional structure for redistricting of the state house and state senate districts says that when the legislature fails to get the job done, the LRB takes its place. And because of that constitutional framework, the Legislative Redistricting Board acts as a legislative policy-making body, and therefore it is cloaked with absolute legislative immunity, not only for the members of the LRB, but for their top legislative aides as well.
Do we need to decide whether the immunity would be absolute in this case? Why do we need to go that far? In Village of Arlington Heights, the United States Supreme Court said that in some extraordinary instances, members might be called to testify. What would some of those extraordinary instances be in your view?
I cannot, Your Honor, think of an extraordinary circumstance in this case where any member of the Legislative Redistricting Board could properly be called.
Don't think outside this case. Help Justice. Okay.
I cannot, even outside of this case, suggest such a situation.
If there were an allegation of bribery, could they be called to the stand?
Well, some of the cases from the U.S. Supreme Court in dealing with grand jury subpoenas ask the question whether the conduct, as opposed to the individual, is something within the sphere of legislative activity. And so if the conduct is outside the scope of the activity that immunity applies to.
Okay, and has that been alleged here that there's been any conduct outside the scope of legislative activity?
We think not. Clearly, the deposition notices, which we move to compel, say that they're looking for all statements and evidence of consideration and formulation of the legislative redistricting plans.
But was any argument made to the trial court, or has there been any allegation of conduct outside the legislative scope?
No. The only allegation I've seen, Your Honor, is in the pleadings below by the other side, where they say there is a 14th and 15th United States constitutional prohibition because they acted outside the scope of those amendments.
Well, what pleading are we on? I think the only pleading we have in the record is the original pleading. Has that been amended?
I believe that in the Brown case it's been amended. I also believe in the other matter, Breedlove, there's been an amendment. But what I'm referring to is not the pleading, but rather the motion that reacted to our actual request of the trial court to quash these depositions. And what they said there, and what they've said here, I believe, and in the intermediate court on mandamus, is that they think there's some intentional act in violation of the federal constitution. The case out of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1998, Justice Thomas speaking for a unanimous high court, it's called Brogan, that case specifically rejects unanimously the idea that some violation of the United States Constitution would somehow fall outside the sphere of the absolute immunity that is granted to members who act as legislatures,
but
as the case may be.
Given the scope of the LRB and its function, should the court consider any sort of tradition of the members of the LRB to make themselves available for their depositions?
I think not. The cases both in the U.S. Supreme Court and in the lower courts make clear that the right to assert absolute immunity is a personal one, belonging to the individual who's cloaked with it. And so therefore, simply because in past decades, members who have the right to invoke that absolute immunity and choose not to, does not then mean that there's some custom or practice that should invade the province of this constitutional right. And so therefore, Your Honor, we would submit that the citation by the other side, I believe, to the Graves case, where it just so happened that members of the LRB voluntarily decided to be deposed, has nothing to do with whether or not under our federal system or our state court system there is an absolute immunity that these individuals rightfully can invoke.
Are the plaintiffs entitled to know or have copies of or get somehow identified everything that the LRB considered in making their decision?
I think the answer is yes.
And how do they do that?
Well, first, the LRB, of course, met over seven meetings spanning almost 60 days, and all of that was recorded by a court reporter. All of the testimony.
For example, if there was some allegation, there isn't one in this case, but suppose there were an allegation that a legislative body violated the Open Meetings Act or did not make public all the documents or memos that they considered in reaching their decision, how would a plaintiff go about discovering it?
Well, I think that in the hypothetical that you raise, where there's some claim of a criminal violation, for example, of the open meetings law, there may be jurisdiction in some local prosecutor to try to determine if those criminal laws were violated. And the question that that court, if a motion to quash was filed, would have to wrestle with is whether or not the act is one that is completely immune from discovery and absolutely privileged or not. It's not the title of the individual involved. It's not the cause of action that's being pled. It's not whether it's criminal or civil in nature, but rather it is the act. It is not the motivation or the desires of the individuals who are acting that cause this shield to come into play, but rather the fact that they're acting as a legislative body. Now, the case law is clear that it doesn't solely apply to members of the legislature. It can apply to members of the judiciary. It can apply to members of the executive branch. What really depends is what is the activity? What is the function that they're performing? And the courts, I think, make clear that there's a line of demarcation between are they policymakers who are actually creating law, as opposed to are these folks who are not making the law, but they're simply enforcing it.
Well,
and that's
let me
why
get this. Go ahead.
My simple question is, are you entitled as a plaintiff to know what the legislative body considered in reaching its decision or not? And if so, how do you go about getting discovery of that?
Short of
asking them, do I have it all?
The answer to your question is that there is a public record. The public record in this case is in the form of testimony before the LRB. The public record includes documentation that was submitted for the LRB's perusal and consideration.
How do you get behind that and say, is this it? Did you all talk about anything in meetings that were not public?
Well, I believe that the privilege is absolute. If in a civil context somebody is trying to glean what the motivations were of the actors, that is shielded from discovery. In your hypothetical, not here, in a criminal context, where someone, for example, is trying to learn if a criminal law was violated, such as was discussed at some length in the Gabel case in the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe in 1967, that there was a question of whether or not the actual activity was legislative in nature. And they gave an example. What if, for example, the Pentagon Papers were not subpoenaed by a group, but rather what if one of the members just walked over to the office building and stole them? Well, obviously the act, the improper, illegal act of stealing the Pentagon Papers, as the High Court said in Gabel, wouldn't be appropriate because it's not something within the sphere of legislative activity. But in this case, the actions that the other side are seeking to learn in discovery are those actions which are quintessentially legislative in nature. What went into your vote?
Two kind of unrelated questions. First is, did I understand you correctly to say that in an open records case, civil cases of the type we get several a year, that legislative members do not have to give discovery?
I'm not saying that one way or the other. What I am saying is that if there were a criminal prosecution and
I'm talking about a civil case. Dallas Morning versus City of Garland.
Right. In a civil case, our position clearly is that the absolute legislative immunity is invoked if you're seeking discovery from a legislature, but that's not the end of the test. The second prong of that test is whether or not the activity that they're seeking to discover is an activity within the province of legislative behavior.
Now,
I'm suggesting in answer to the hypothetical that an open records violation may well be something that's outside the scope of normal legislative activity, but that's not this case.
Now, more closely related to this case, what is your position about whether or not the individual motivation of legislators or board members may be relevant in deciding whether or not a redistricting plan is legal?
We believe that it is not relevant.
Ever?
Ever. The reason being...
There's some language to the contrary kind of floating around in some cases.
If I might address that, Mr. Chief Justice, I believe there's a couple of issues there. One is, how do you glean legislative intent from a law that's been passed? The court's spoken about that to some extent in one of the parental notification cases, talking about, you know, if it's a post-enactment statement by a single legislator about what the enactment meant, that raises serious questions as to whether the character of that type of evidence would be...
I think she's talking about U.S. Supreme Court precedent in the redistricting area. Can you address that?
Yes. The High Court has not specifically spoken in the redistricting context of the admissibility or predictability of that kind of evidence. What I can say, and I'll have to reference the Marylanders case, which notably is not a U.S. Supreme Court case. It's a three-judge federal district court case that comes out of Maryland. But what they say there is that it is not a situation where it is appropriate to actually put into evidence the thinking, the motivation, the expression of reliance of a particular voter who passed some sort of a legislative enactment, because that is not competent evidence, it is not material evidence, it is not relevant evidence. And the policy reason behind it, Your Honor, is it allows you to do indirectly what you could not do directly. And that is, if we allow the admissibility of evidence of individual legislators as to what was driving a particular vote, then that puts the defendants in the position of having the Hobson's choice of, do we stand on principle because we're allowed not to have to take the stand or be deposed, or are we going to have to go into court, waive our immunity, because it's necessary to properly defend the case? I would suggest that's precisely the case here, because the immunity is absolute, and yet they're trying to get three of the members to be deposed and may well ask the other two members to voluntarily give up their immunity and to actually testify.
Let me get back to this absoluteness query, because that's what I find troublesome. If the deposition notice here were more specific and said, we want to take the deposition notices to inquire as to whether there were activities outside the legislative function, such as violation of Open Meetings Act, bribery, anything like that, would you say there's immunity for that, to even discover whether any illegal activity occurred?
Well, in the context of a civil case, where what the court's going to be called upon is the legality and constitutionality of a redistricting plan, I would submit that the questions you're raising in your hypothetical don't relate to that particular case.
So you did not allow them to even make inquiry into whether anything improper went on?
That's correct. In the civil context, we think that would be inappropriate.
But why do you say the civil context? What are they then to do? Go into the criminal courts and request some relief?
Well, what I'm trying to suggest is that in the civil context, if the actual person to be deposed is a member of the legislature or acts as a legislature, as an LRB member and a staffer here, or the actual act upon which they're trying to discover is something that's within the sphere of the legislative function, it's absolute.
But that gets me back to my question. Robbery would not be within the sphere of the legislative action.
That's right.
So why would we not allow a deposition to go forward to find out if there was any bribery?
Well,
I mean, I'm not suggesting that there is, of course. This is an outrageous hypothetical, but that's where I have problems with the absolute approach.
Sure.
I can see instances where an allegation might be made that there was conduct outside the legislative scope, and it sounds to me like you're saying that's out of bounds as well.
Well, I have to go back to what I said to the other justice, and that's the Gavel case. In that case, they said that the way to draw the line between what's appropriate inquiry and what's not is whether or not the conduct that's being alleged is illegal and outside the sphere of legislative enactment. So, for example, if you're saying somebody committed a bribe in your hypothetical, then that may well be a situation where the contours of the shape of that particular privilege would be overcome. But what I'm saying is that it is absolute, not qualified, if the person to be deposed is acting in a legislative capacity, and second, the action is that it's quintessentially legislative.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, I think you're saying that if they were seeking to inquire about bribery, that would be okay, because that is not a quintessentially legislative function.
I think that's right.
All right, well, then let's take that a step further, bribery being illegal, equal protection violation, next step being illegal, illegal intent to discriminate. Why wouldn't the same analysis apply?
Because of Brogan. Brogan, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1998, through Justice Thomas, unanimously said that we're going to draw the line, even though a claim of insidious violation of the federal Constitution has been made. The policy choice of absolute immunity should prevent, not allow, the taking of that type of deposition or trial for testimony.
Well, let's take a look at Arlington Heights real quickly. It strikes me that when you don't just look at the effect of the alleged discrimination, you do look at the intent, the motivation behind the legislation, and they give us some parameters to look for to determine that intent. And there seems to be that they're laying out different things that you can look to or do discovery on to find intent, such as historical background. They name about three or four things. And then at the end of this list, they talk about only in extraordinary circumstances, which was my original question, can you get to individual legislators' intent. If we follow that construct, can't we then say they can look at all these other things that presumably are of record in this case, and they have not shown extraordinary circumstances to go beyond those at this point, based upon the scope of their deposition request?
I think the court could go that direction
and
if
that direction is followed, then we don't need to address absolute versus non-absolute immunity.
Well, I think the court, if it wanted to, could say that the scope of absolute immunity is not covered here because the deposition doesn't get into the areas of your hypothetical. But I would submit that this is an opportunity, and it's properly presented before the court, to actually state what this court thinks about the contours of absolute legislative immunity. And certainly here, with a group that's acting as a legislature.
Are there any limits on what the plaintiffs are seeking here? In other words, they're saying that there is, in their pleadings here, they think that there is a purpose or intent of minimizing racial minority voting strength. But let's talk about other legislation. The principles that they apply and the rationale for getting behind the motives of a particular piece of, or a vote of a legislator, have they given us any way to confine that? Or are we going to, if we were to adopt their reasoning, would we be facing a situation where every time the legislature is in session, every legislator is going to be deposed?
I think it's the latter. It's Katie bar the door, Your Honor, because if we're going to open the door, it's not absolute anymore. It's going to a qualified kind of immunity. And one of the things we're trying not to do is to chill the expression of conduct and activity and thoughtful voice in the legislative arena, because the forefathers said that that's what we should be doing. The speech and debate clause of the federal Constitution is much akin to the text of the Texas Constitution, and the common law decisions of the High Court and the common law decisions of the courts of appeals in this state, I believe, make it clear that this is a policy choice our forefathers chose, and we should adhere to it, because in the end, the public is better off.
Would you speak to the attorney-client and work product privilege, which they say don't exist in this case?
Sure. The members of the LRB retain legal counsel, and so separate and apart, Your Honor, from the public records that the LRB considered, was the giving of advice by legal counsel to members of the LRB. The scope of the document requests in the six deposition notices is quite broad and could be interpreted to go farther than the public record and to actually get into the confidential records. Understand, we've had 19 cases filed this time, and understand the first one was filed in December of last year. So during the entire time that the LRB was meeting, it was under the microscope of litigation. And so it was appropriate for members to seek legal advice, and we would submit, if we were in a situation back before the trial court trying to protect those documents, that that advice was confidential.
Well, I'm a little confused with the answer about the document per se. seemed to me it was directed to getting the Red Apple software, whatever in the world that is, anything that had to do with that, which seemed to be not quite so broad as you intimate it might be. But their point is that they're not asking for what legal advice might have been given by a lawyer, but what was the intent of the individual person in voting for these plans. And so they question why you tried to raise those privileges in this case.
We believe the scope of the document request was formulation and consideration by the LRB of any redistricting plans. Members of the LRB were receiving legal advice on whether particular plans might or might not trigger potential violations of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, whether or not they might trigger DOJ objections under Section 5 and the like. And so there is documentation, I made this clear in the court below, that does exist that constitutes confidential communications between the LRB members and their lawyers.
Well, if that's the case, did you follow the process that our discovery rules specify when you're going to claim that privilege of any documents you might have?
What happened in the trial court below was the threshold question of whether absolute immunity would cloak the records and the individuals from being discovered in this case. That, of course, is up before you now. If this court were to decide that the absolute immunity does not exist and we're back before the court, it would be at that time that we would submit documents in camera and support them by evidence. I believe, and counsel can correct me, that it's been the understanding between he and I that we would try to get the threshold issue decided, and once decided, deal with the documents. I want to make it clear that every single document that the LRB relied on that's part of the public record is open. It was submitted to the Justice Department, and it was submitted to the plaintiffs in this case, so they have the public record. In this answer, I'm talking about confidential documents.
The Senate plan has been pre-cleared?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the House not yet?
Not yet. We met with the Department of Justice about a week ago. I lose track of the time in this case, but they are looking at additional information and have told us that they will try to get back to us as expeditiously as possible. Under their administrative rules, they could take another 60 days if they so choose, and I don't know how long or how short it will be.
Is it better to go to trial with preclearance or without, or it doesn't matter?
Well, are you asking me in state court or federal court?
Either one.
In federal court, the case law is clear that the federal panel cannot render judgment, but I do believe the federal panel can actually hold an evidentiary trial for people to make their claims about the propriety of the House plan, for example. The court doesn't have jurisdiction on Section 5. It's going to be limited to Section 2 challenges and federal and state constitutional challenges. They could go forward. I don't think, as a practical matter, we're going to go forward in the state case because the court may or may not be aware that the federal court has decided to go forward next Monday in the congressional case, and then immediately following that to go forward in the LRB case. And no longer do we have a situation with four judges sitting. It's only the three federal judges. So Judge Davis is not involved in that case. But I hasten to add that the case in the trial court has not been dismissed. The order denying our motion is still alive. Obviously, we have opposition about whether these depositions should or should not occur in state court. So we believe it's a live issue, even though there's no current trial setting.
No current trial setting.
Correct.
In the state.
Correct.
And in the federal, it's just whenever you get to the congressional.
That's right. And one additional point that may be relevant to your question, this quest for depositions first started in federal court. It didn't start in state court. And we actually had a hearing, and the federal court said we would rather find out what the state court thinks about this issue because we're staying our hand at this point. So I think they bounced it back here, and I think it's indicative that they do care about what the High Court of this state thinks about this very important issue. They have the power to decide it on a federal law basis. You have a power to decide it on your basis. But I do believe that the ruling that you make will be very important to the federal court's consideration if and when this issue arises in federal court.
Sort of a certified question. advisory, sort of.
I kind of wondered if a certified question was appropriate when you have one member of the Fifth Circuit involved, but we figured that was too complicated to even try to do.
Now, are we to review the trial court's order here for abuse of discretion?
Yes.
And in looking at whether there's an abuse of discretion, don't we need to look at the live pleadings to see what's been pled?
Yes.
We don't have a live pleadings. What are we to do with that? Don't we presume that they would support what the trial court did?
I will have to check the record. As the court knows, we're moving in rifle shot speed.
But for example, if the live pleading were to plead that there was some irregularity with the LRB proceedings, bribery, meeting outside the Open Meetings Act, then I think we would have to look at it in a different gloss in terms of looking at the trial court's discretion. So,
I understand. Perhaps it would make sense to submit the live pleadings to the court before it makes its decision. I can represent to you that the live pleadings aren't any different with respect to the issues that we've discussed.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Mr. Ed Klautman will present argument for the real parties in interest.
May it please the court.
There's been redistricting litigation in almost every state in each of the last now five election cycles.
Yes, sir. I think that's fair to say.
There's no case on point on this particular issue. Is that fair to say?
I cannot find one that is on all fours with our situation.
There are some references to deposition testimony.
Yes, sir.
In various opinions. Is there anything else?
Here in Texas, those references exist for the 1970 round and the 1980 round. There was references to depositions of the governor, members of the LRB, and there is no record as to how that occurred other than it did.
Now, so if we really are writing on a clean slate,
I believe that you are right.
I still don't believe, but maybe that's the case.
I believe you're writing on a relatively clean slate. There's certainly a law that would help you and shape, I think, your thinking. I would hope it would. And I need to address a couple of things I think that would be formative in that process. The Village of Arlington Heights is a seminal case relative to the intention inquiry. Whether the 14th Amendment has been violated in some fashion is an intent question. In the voting context, the Supreme Court in Miller versus Johnson goes through sort of a very detailed analysis of what the intent or purpose they're looking for needs to be in terms
so
of the violation.
District?
Pardon me?
If our LRB had a pure heart and really wanted to do a great district, and they drew a district that drew two districts that split the Hispanic vote and denied them their preference, but they had a pure heart, that district might be okay. Whereas the same district, if it was drawn with evil motive, would not be okay?
Your Honor, I think it might violate Section 2 in the first instance because the effect of that division may violate the Voting Rights Act. But in terms of the intentional discrimination claims, obviously you're not always going to find someone on the record as saying, what I really want to do here is minimize minority voting strength, but rather you infer from the totality of their conduct that that's what the process was about.
But you're saying there is a subjective component. I mean, the same lines may be the same lines with the same voting numbers may be constitutional and legal under one set of drawers and illegal and unconstitutional with another set.
No, Your Honor. I said they may evade the constitutional challenge by lack of proof to show that there was an evil motive or purpose at the...
I think the question is, what does motive have to do with it? Is it an objective test or subjective test? If the lines as drawn meet every constitutional requirement, one man, one vote, what difference does it make if the lines were drawn with a clean heart, a pure heart, or an evil heart?
Because the 15th Amendment speaks to that question, and the 15th Amendment cases specifically hold that if racial motivation takes over in terms of where district lines are drawn in the voting context, it may abridge the 15th Amendment right to vote. But again, it's an intent question.
Is that subjective? You're saying it's totally subjective, or is it objective, or is it mixed?
It may be an indirect evidence proof model is what I'm suggesting to you. That often don't find direct evidence of racial bias in these cases.
You can see we're struggling with this. If the deponents, the would-be deponents in this case, testify that they were not racially motivated, then you lose?
No, I don't believe that, because they always testify to that, Your Honor.
Well, then I would expect that they would.
And that is what you would expect. But if, for instance, the discovery, if we obtained it, would show that the directions given by member A to staff was to minimize certain neighborhoods' impact on the district by removing them, and you showed a pattern of doing so across their proposals to the others, and that turned out to be the plan that was voted upon and adopted, you may be able to infer from that there was an impure motive at foot. We don't know that because we haven't got the discovery.
That would give you a victory that you would not otherwise have just based on the numbers. I mean, that's what we're struggling with.
Well, Your Honor, I think
it's really more than the numbers.
It is more than the numbers. It is what.
But
what
you have a case that says that.
Well,
without talking
surely,
about who has to.
Surely.
Case
the Miller case says just that. If you have to get at the intent through indirect evidence, you need to be able to establish what was motivating the conduct of the state actors.
All right, let me
redistrict.
Yes,
let me follow up on that. Again, the same questions I asked of Mr. Taylor in Village of Arlington Heights, because they seem to talk about that you need proof of racially discriminatory intent
right.
to show a violation. And then it goes into what this proof would look like. And they go through several items of what this proof would look like. Historical background of the decision is one evidentiary source. They specific sequences of events leading up to the challenge decision. On and on, they list several things that you could use to show this motivational intent. And then they conclude it with, in some extraordinary instances, the members might be called to testify. What extraordinary instances exist here that would allow that testimony to be taken?
I would direct your attention to Appendix Tab I, the last meeting of the LRB, in which they took public testimony, comment, heard proposals and arguments for most of the day, and then retired from the public. And their deliberations are recorded in the last few pages of Tab I, wherein new amendments for the first time were being offered, amendments that no one had seen in the public, not even other members of the LRB had seen, and they proceeded to vote upon those amendments without any evidentiary background at all. No public exposure, no comment, and
that
some objection.
That sounds reminiscent of what we're going to be hearing tomorrow, doesn't it?
I'm not sure what you're going to hear tomorrow.
Okay, well, in
I know there is an argument, but I'm not going to make it.
In any event, your extraordinary circumstances are?
That what drove the process for these midnight amendments, if you will, to the plans that the LRB ultimately adopted for the House and Senate? What was going on is what we don't
well,
know. There's no record of it.
All these amendments and this stuff you're talking about is part of the public record. The documentation that was relied upon, the evidence that was relied upon, everything the LRB looked at was part of the public record, correct?
No. We don't know what they looked at for these amendments. These amendments were never brought into the public record. They are brought up in the last session of the LRB when the public comment period had concluded. And amendments were made by members of the LRB to plans that were part of the public record, and there's not a shred of information as to what made the difference in these, why did these amendments were being offered at the last
I'm
minute.
Not clear.
At the last.
If they used amendments that you haven't seen, the effect of those amendments show in the plan that
oh, yes.
was ultimately.
We know what the amendments accomplished.
So you know what the objective.
We don't know what the intent was. We don't know what directions were given staff
well,
members.
Well, let me ask the reverse question from what the Chief asked or Justice said. If you don't get the discovery, how will you prove your assertion?
I'm afraid we will not be able to.
Can I ask a question about that? Justice Baker, let me ask you this on Miller. You say you don't know the intent. Doesn't Miller say that until a claimant makes a showing sufficient to support an allegation of race-based decision-making, the good faith of a state legislature must be presumed. Why shouldn't we? You're saying right now that there is no evidence whatsoever. You have a suspicion that there may be some improper motivation here, but it's nothing more than a suspicion, and you haven't come forward with anything else, and Miller seems to require that you at least come forward with some form of case before discovery would be permitted.
I think all Miller requires us to do, Your Honor, and maybe we read it differently, is to conclude or allege that there is mischief here, it appears, in within the parameters of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause or the 15th Amendment's Protection of the Right to Vote.
Miller says the plaintiff must show, either through circumstantial evidence of a district's shape and demographics or more direct evidence going to legislative purpose, that race was the predominant factor motivating the legislation.
Absolutely. And you do that with discovery. That's how you show that. You can't show it without knowing the facts that support
but it
the
requires more than an allegation. Miller does.
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I believe what they're giving you the analysis of what a proof model would look like in trial after you have the information to show the intent of the actor.
Mr. Cook, I'm confused. Are you saying that these amendments are not part of the public record?
The amendments are named in the public record. They are offered by one or more sponsors in the public record at Tab I, but you don't know from what out of left field these events are coming. They were not part of the public comment period. They were not explained. They were not even on the Red Apple computer until hours before the last day. And some of them not even then. Some of them were actually offered during the last day appearance.
I want to go
what we don't know is what happened. What drove these changes? And that is the focus of our discovery.
But it sounds like everything you've said would be in every single case. I mean, I think you would agree that the LRB was acting as a legislative function.
I don't.
You don't agree.
I'd like to get there, though. Well, if I might.
Let's start at the bottom
right.
line.
Certainly it's named and described in Article 3 of the Texas Constitution. So are several other boards and commissions, by the way, who I think we all would suggest are not acting as the legislature or in the stead.
Well, now, wait a minute. Aren't they acting the same way the governor did in the Marylanders case? What is the LRB doing any differently here than the governor was doing in the Marylanders case?
Because there, the legislature had the ability to come in and act with the governor, and did, as a matter of fact, act with the governor in the Marylanders case after he had proposed a plan.
But that
here, the LRB stands alone. No veto.
But
no,
that doesn't
no review.
Impact on whether it's exercising a legislative function.
Well, maybe it may appear to be doing so. Would a commission of citizens be doing the same thing if appointed by a
governor? It says that what they do shall have force and effect of law.
Well, certainly it does. But all they would have to do under the Constitution, as I read, would be show up one day, decide on one map, in about 5 minutes, vote it out, and be done.
Well,
that's not what
they do. You said there's no veto and no review. What do you mean, and who do you think gets a veto to what the LRB might say?
No one does. But if the legislature had acted as the legislature, voted out a plan of the House and a plan of the Senate, the governor could veto it. It's that simple. It's a bill. This is not that process. This is a default process.
Do you have any authority to support that proposition that this is not a legislative function?
Only the logic I'm trying to give you here. It simply is when the legislature has failed under the Constitution to discharge its duties, we go into this other mechanism.
And what's the source of the other mechanism?
The Article 3 of the Texas Constitution.
Isn't that pretty heavy authority?
Well, it describes what they should do, but it also describes what several other boards and commissions do. I don't necessarily think that means they're cloaked with legislative immunity for what they do.
But if this is not a legislative activity, what is it?
Well, it could be the activity of a special board or commission set up to do nothing more than redistrict once every 10 years.
Well, but how do you define legislative activity?
Well, Your Honor,
let me start with this. You would agree that it has a broader meaning than just the activity, say, of the Texas legislature within its chambers enacting laws.
I think the cases stand for that problem.
All right. So how do you define legislative activity?
Well, an activity that looks like and smells like and tastes like legislation. This is not that. This is simply a group of five people, three of whom are executives at State.
But you just defined the term using the term. I mean, definition would you give it? Isn't it enacting policy?
It's an act of policy. I would agree with that. I don't think it fits the legislative immunity definition, because what we're trying to do here is protect legislators from being interfered with in the discharge of their duties. Well, they don't have duties after they act. For 10 more years, they cannot even meet.
But by law, they are constituted to act at this point in time and to basically establish policy, establish a plan.
Yes.
Why isn't that legislative activity as opposed to
enforcement activity, which might be something else. And they actually are setting policy here, aren't they?
I think they're actually enforcing the Texas Constitution, which says we must have a redistricting plan every 10 years. Is what
they're
about.
They're actually making the plan.
They are. They are indeed.
Assuming they're a legislative body. Sorry, Judge. Assuming they're a legislative body, let's assume that.
Roger.
I'm concerned about the impact on other legislative bodies. So are we going to be opening up every city councilman now and every county commissioner to be subjected to deposition?
I don't think so, but let me tell you, maybe offer one more explanation that's part of my answer to that. And it is not the intent of this discovery request to figure out why you voted for something, but why you gave instructions to do what the product or to shape the product in the way it was shaped. Now, if
Can
I wanted to depose
every city council and county commissioner,
maybe not, because in those instances, I might be looking to the persons in the city planning department who I could depose, who drew the plans, who I could figure out from the instructions given what they were about. Here, we have the LRB members and their staff, and it's a very small group, I think, of people who are giving instructions, receiving information, responding with instructions, and it's a little bit different to me than the city council acting to say, all right, city attorney, go hire somebody, draw us a map that does this, and we'll vote on it. I'm not asking why you voted for or against the LRB plan. I'm asking how it got to be the plan to begin with. How did these changes happen on July 24th? What was going on?
But I'm still confused about how it could be if you tell a staffer to draw me up a plan that's racially discriminatory.
Yes, sir.
Because the one thing I want to accomplish here before the day's done is racial discrimination. And he doesn't do that. The plan he comes back with doesn't. Then is the plan infirm because of his instructions and intent?
No, I think in that instance probably not, because it did not result in the harm.
And then if he says to his staffer, on the other hand, for God's sake, whatever you do, don't draw me up a racially discriminatory plan, because we're going to follow the law and we want to make sure that everybody's treated fairly. And the staffer does, whether intent by or mistake, draw up such a plan. Is it any less subject to challenge because the principal did not want it to happen?
Certainly under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, it's subject to challenge because its effect is discriminatory. But that's really, I think you're asking in the confines of an intentional discrimination case.
Was the fact that the Senate plan's been pre-cleared have any preclusion on you asking questions regarding the Senate plan?
No, it does not. The effect of the Section 5 pre-clearance is to say that in the opinion of the Department of Justice, there is no retrogression. That is, it provides no less opportunity than the plans historically in the Senate, the last plan specifically, offered minorities to elect the candidate of their choice. That's a different standard than saying either Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act may be violated or that there's some intentional race bias in drawing up lines to minimize minority voting strength. And those do violate the constitutional principle.
Since we don't have the pleadings, would you tell me what is the ultimate relief that your clients want vis-a-vis the plan that was approved?
We want a court to find both the House and Senate plans infirm because of the Voting Rights Act violations and the 14th Amendment and 15th Amendment constitutional violations. By the way, we're on the Fourth Amendment petition, if that helps to answer your question, and not the first.
Are you contending they're facially discriminatory?
I don't think we've used the term facially discriminatory in our pleadings. That is. I know not of a term of art that is required under the 14th and 15th Amendment. We certainly said that they are intentionally and by effect discriminating based on race.
If the members of the LRB are in fact engaged in that legislative activity, to what extent are they immune?
Are they
immune?
I think the policy question, just as Justice Phillips asked early, writing on the clean slate, is before you. I think we have to square up the dictates of the Miller case, Arlington Heights case, and say if you have allegations of intentional race bias in the state act of conduct, you have to show that what their intention or motivation was by direct or indirect evidence, by circumstantial evidence in many cases. And that's one thing you often get from state actors through discovery or oral testimony in trial. Contrast it with this notion that they are immune from ever talking about what they did or why they did it. The illegal conduct is violating the principal document of our government, the Constitution of the United States, and the laws that are enacted under that constitutional framework. That is unlawful conduct. If you can't get at that by asking people what instructions you gave to your staff and how did the map get to be in the shape it was, what operating principles were you using, what traditional redistricting principles were you trying to adhere to, what historical guidelines were, may have guided your thinking, we'll never know what race bias was in their hearts.
So then is it your position that there is no such thing as legislative immunity? It does not attach to any act on the part of some of a government official performing a legislative function.
No, I don't believe that. I would go anywhere near that far.
So what, under what circumstances would the members of the LRB, if they are performing a legislative activity, able to avail themselves of legislative immunity?
Certainly just to avoid any liability over their conduct. No one is suing them. No one is claiming any relief against them. They're not parties in the lawsuit.
So as far as discovery in a lawsuit is concerned, they're fair game. There are no limits on your seeking discovery from them.
I believe there are limits. There are limits.
That's what I'm trying to understand. I mean, I understand you're over here in this box saying we should be able to do this. And what I'm asking, does that cover the whole playing field so there really is no such thing as legislative immunity? Or are there limits to what you can discover? And if there are, then what protection does legislative immunity provide?
Well, for instance, guiding your thinking, we'll never know what race bias was in their hearts.
So then is it your position that there is no such thing as legislative immunity? It does not attach to any act... on the part of some of a government official performing a legislative function.
No, I don't believe that. I would go anywhere near that far.
So what? Under what circumstances would the members of the LRB, if they are performing a legislative activity, able to avail themselves of legislative immunity?
Certainly, just to avoid any liability over their conduct. No one is suing them. No one is claiming any relief against them. They're not parties in the lawsuit.
So as far as discovery in a lawsuit is concerned, they're fair game. There are no limits on your seeking discovery from them.
I believe there are limits. There are limits.
That's what I'm trying to understand. I mean, I understand you're over here in this box saying we should be able to do this. And what I'm asking, does that cover the whole playing field so there really is no such thing as legislative immunity? Or are there limits to what you can discover? And if there are, then what protection does legislative immunity provide?
Well, for instance, I think there would be a limit and more properly sought by a motion for protective order as opposed to a motion to quash the entire process that would say why a member voted for a certain bill or plan or not is part of that legislative immunity if it exists. It's not why you voted for it. It's what did you do to cause this result to be voted on to begin with that we want to get at? What instructions?
So you can't ask them why they voted the way they did, but you can ask them why they formulated the plan in the first place.
Why did you tell John Doe to go draw the lines in Harris County, in this fashion or that fashion, when you knew it divided along racial lines in the county and kept people in or out of a certain district? Why did you do that?
Okay, but they are immune from being asked why they voted the way they voted.
I don't think that is proof of anything. But one, I don't think.
What other protection does the immunity provide?
Certainly, the attorney-client work product problems we had to agree to what goes out, but I think those are an aside.
That's a different issue. I'm trying to understand the extent of that legislative immunity would exist on your theory in this case.
Well, I don't think there's any immunity for any question that addresses intentional discrimination.
No, I understand you keep saying what there is an immunity. I'm just trying to understand what there is immunity.
Well, that would be the end of the inquiry in this case. Now, whether that has an effect on other cases, I think you'd have to take it on a case-by-case basis. And that may happen. If you say, for instance, we are an open government, we are a government that ought to explain to people why things happen,
And that may bring more motions for protective order or motions to quash before you. I don't know, there won't. But maybe that's how we got to run our government.
We asked several questions of the relators about the scope of discovery. Is your proposed scope and purpose of discovery correctly stated in your opposition to the state defendant's motion to quash in the trial court and your filing in this court?
I have added some case law in support of that in addition to that, but yes, sir, I think it's correct.
But when we talk about bribery and open meetings, you're not looking into that.
There are no allegations in our petition as to either matter.
And or other sort of criminal.
No, we're not alleging any criminal conduct.
And there's no trial setting in the state court?
No, sir. I think there's been a request for a trial setting made yesterday or today. I'm not sure, but I don't know that we're going to get one, and I don't know when it will be if we get one.
Your understanding is the same as relators, that the federal court tends to go forward as soon as the congressional trials is open.
I believe their term was as soon as practicable after they finish the congressional hearings. Yes,
and you also agree that this discovery issue was raised in federal court also, and they're sort of
hoping
we'll decide.
We noticed August 27th these depositions. They have been bounced from that court to Judge Davis to the Third Court of Appeals to you folks, and here we are without an answer.
Now, I have just a couple of questions. It's not clear to me, Mr. Plotman, from your argument, why you say they're not entitled to legislative immunity. It seems to me we have a couple of, I guess, Court of Appeals cases that talk in terms of the function that's being performed is what implicates legislative immunity. You've argued that the LRB is not the legislature, they're not entitled to it, but then you argue also that function is not. Do you agree it's the function being performed that implicates legislative immunity, or do you are you insisting that it's the position of being a legislator that implicates?
Well, I think the case law suggests it's the function that's being performed. Now, and the question here is whether that function is it anything like the legislator's function. I think it's radically different.
All right. And then the second question, and even if we determine that the function is a legislative function, you would take the position that even if it was a legislature, they'd not be entitled to immunity if the allegation of conduct against them is a racially motivated conduct.
Yes,
you would say the immunity doesn't even apply, even if it's Representative Smith over there on the floor of the House arguing in favor of amendment to a bill. If it's racially motivated, you can depose them about why they directed that amendment.
And I would say yes to your question, and also refer you to Hunter against Underwood, a Supreme Court case of 1985, in which the Supreme Court validated an inquiry to the 1901 Alabama legislature and applied it into this Constitution in the manner it did. They got into why this happened and what was the effect of it or purpose of it without even having a live legislator to ask the question. They took evidence that was so circumstantial about their intent because it was so important to the resolution of the issues in that case. I just think that concern trumps the ordinary notion that you can't sue someone who's performing a legislative function. Otherwise, we'll never get to the intent.
Mr. Clinton, let me make sure I understand the arguments that have been made, because I think I'm hearing arguments here that I didn't see in your response.
I may have gotten them more fine-tuned.
Well, that presents a bit of a problem if it's not in a response with the court. As I read your response here, I don't recall any discussion about whether this was or was not a legislative function. And that may have spawned a lot of questions on the court, because they may have not seen that in the briefing either. But that your argument was any sort of immunity only attaches to liability and not to discovery.
I certainly did say that, and I think that is still the law that this court can and should apply. I do believe that the function itself has changed from legislative to a more constitutional enforcement mechanism, because when the legislature defaults, this whole process goes to a non-legislature type body.
Was this argument made in the trial court?
We never got to talk to the trial court. I mean, we filed opposition to
motion
to quash. No.
So there's nothing in writing anywhere for us to latch on to your argument?
No, I think not.
Okay.
Picking up on what Justice O'Neill said, the difference between legislative liability and legislative discovery. What did the U.S. Supreme Court mean in the Dombowski case when they said, for the purposes of that immunity, legislators should be protected not only from the consequences of litigation results, but also from the burden of defending themselves?
And I would say that means they don't have to answer as a defendant in a lawsuit. I don't think that means they don't have to give up documents.
Would you also say that would include the ability not to be discovered either if you don't have to answer?
Well, I think that's what the state is arguing for certain. I don't read that.
Doesn't that statement support the state's argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think rather we're talking about the burdens of defending one's conduct as a defendant, as a person who may be enjoined or found in some declaration to have violated the law. We're not seeking any such relief here.
So you just don't name him as a defendant, and it's Katie bar the door.
I don't think Katie bar the door is our discovery process, but can we get discovery in context of a racial bias case? I think we should.
Well, but I'm having trouble seeing the distinction you draw between whether they're a defendant or not, because the statement's made in the Marylanders case that legislative immunity not only protects state legislators from civil liability, but also functions as an evidentiary and testimonial privilege, and you would limit that to only if they're named as defendants in the case.
I would say that, with all due respect to the pre-judge court sitting in Maryland, they're wrong. It's not the law, as I read it. It's not the law, as the Supreme Court seems to articulate the intent question in these cases.
Well, there are five members of the LRB, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Is there any significance that you've only asked to depose three of the five?
There were the three, if you look at tab I, who were voting on these amendments without having any public record or testimony
well,
about
did
them.
The other two vote?
They voted against them and complained about the process.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I'd like to return to the Bogan case that I cited earlier from the High Court in 1998, unanimous case, authored by Justice Thomas. The plaintiff sued because of an ordinance, and the municipality was sued by her for the elimination of her position. And she said that elimination was motivated by racial animus and a desire to retaliate against her, and she made federal constitutional claims. And the court said two things I'd like to mention. First, they said that whether an act is legislative turns on the nature of the act rather than on the motive or the intent of the official performing it. And second, the court said this leaves us with the question whether, stripped of all considerations of intent and motive, petitioner's actions were legislative. And they said that they had little trouble contending and concluding that, in fact, they were. And so the question here is whether the passing of law in the form of a redistricting plan for the Senate and the House is a legislative act. And even if, which we strenuously deny, there was some improper animus going on, the question is whether it's a privileged act. Now, to take the hypothetical, however, about maybe there's something wrong here and we need to get into it, I would hearken back to the old adage that the proof's in the pudding, Your Honor, and what you do, as was done in the Bush v. Vera case in 1994, is you point to the map, you point to the statistical package, you have expert witnesses, and you try to draw a fact finder to conclude that the only thing that could be explaining these lines is some improper motive. And in fact, three of the congressional districts were shot down and upheld by that panel, by the U.S. Supreme Court, because they could not be anything other than racial gerrymanders. And you know what they pointed to? Wasn't any testimony. What they pointed to is that everybody at Ledge Council was using a statistical package, census data at the block level. They actually could figure out the ethnicity of somebody by block. And there could
well,
not
that,
be any
that's,
other...
That's effect. And the cases do say, Arlington Heights does say, effect is not enough.
That's correct.
And you can get into motivational intent. And I think that's kind of what we're focusing on here.
I understand that distinction. I still believe, though, that the argument is the same, that once you decide that the action is legislative in nature, that's the end of the inquiry, because it's absolute, not qualified immunity. But even if you want to go farther than that, what I'm suggesting here is that look at the map, look at the statistical package, and come up with any evidence that the plaintiffs can come up with in court. We submit that there is no possible way that a racially discriminatory claim could be made here because it didn't occur. But this wasn't done in secret. This wasn't some
private process, not subject to open records and open government, and open meetings. We had 7 meetings. All of it was on television. All of it was on the internet. We had thousands of pieces of paper. We had citizens from everywhere come give input. And you know those last-minute changes that my opponents talked about a moment ago? The fact is, you have to get the job done at some point. And what they did was respond to the public input that they had received. We put out plans and got responses and then actually responded to the public input. And so those plans are supported by the evidence that was before it. And of course, the legislative body, unlike a judicial branch, doesn't have to make a judgment based on evidence and over objections of the parties. It's not that kind of an adversarial process. It's a legislative process. They're accountable for their vote, and they're accountable to the public, because if they don't do what the public feels is in the public good, then they'll lose at the polls. The members of the LRB didn't campaign and didn't run for office to have this unwelcome obligation of legislative redistricting. The state legislature is supposed to do that, but they didn't. And so our constitutional framework says that those 5 men and women and their staff had to get the job done, and I believe they did it nobly.
Is that the same get the job done that Judge Davis did in the congressional redistricting cases and adding amendments of advisement?
Well, of course, that'll be argued fully tomorrow. We submit that there's a very significant difference. What happened in the trial court in the congressional case, where there was no legislative enactment and where there was absolutely no opportunity for input as to the confidentiality order that was entered, where alleged counsel was asked to help.
Well, I don't want to get into that. I'm just saying, you're saying it is different.
Absolutely different.
And we'll hear about that.
Absolutely different. Yes, you will.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable.